Hi everyone, welcome to Double or Nothing. I'm going to have a crack at introing our second episode, co-hosting this with Michael Frazis. So it's another beautiful day in Sydney. Michael, what are we talking about today? What's been in your mind?
Look, I think there's been a few things this week. There's a big upcoming event, which is Jerome Powell's going to speak tonight in Australian time. And this is a talk that he famously, like a year ago, he got inflation very wrong. It's kind of the talk that generally sets the tone or can set the tone for the next few months. So it's obviously inflation month on month is now basically flat in the US, but still extremely high year on year. Markets have rallied after this number. And then the Fed sent out speaker after speaker to basically say, we're still going to tighten. But the one person we haven't heard from is Jerome Powell. So it's very interesting to see hear what he has to say. That'll almost certainly move things. The other thing that happened, there were two interesting reports this week that I thought we could talk about. The first is Farfetch and the second is NVIDIA. Both of them interesting for different reasons. So starting with NVIDIA, because more people will know it. NVIDIA like just reported one of the worst results probably they've done in many, many, many years. And one of the worst results I've seen come out of a large cap company. Its revenues were down, its net income was down, I think 60% or more. And it was just a shocker result. I mean, this was one of those companies, like so many, that was just positioned perfectly for COVID. Everyone bought new computers, everyone started gaming, huge growth in like data centers, where they obviously sell a lot of product to. And they just had immense demand. And then there was a component of their gaming revenues, which related to cryptocurrency mining, specifically Ethereum mining. And they're always very cagey about that. They're like, oh, we don't know how much it is. We estimate it's very low. And reality, obviously, we know that everybody around the world was hoovering up chips to do this mining. So we know that can't be true. All those revenues were going somewhere. There was a huge amount of CapEx, lots of listed cryptocurrencies, everybody buying these chips. And that was like that incremental demand on an already tight situation. The most gaming demand ever. Everybody needed multiple computers. If you had a family of five, all of a sudden, where one or two computers might have sufficed, you now need everybody working at home. They were just in the perfect storm of that. And now, one by one, each of those things are reversed. Everyone's bought their computer, they last longer than a year. Gaming is down, and cryptocurrency is also down in a big way. And Ethereum is about to move to proof of stake. So you don't even really need like huge amounts of mining equipment to do it. So all that has created something of a perfect storm for Nvidia. But what I thought was most interesting was that the stock on this like horrific report was actually up 4%. We've seen that again and again in the last few months. Like the first half of this year was just the ugliest price action you've ever seen in your life. Or amongst, I kind of made an error of like kind of ignoring that, or not ignoring it, but just not listening to what the market was saying. And now the market is talking again, and this time it's saying the opposite thing. You've got companies coming out with atrocious results and it's rallying. And I say rallying, these stocks are all still down massively, 50% plus from their highs, many still down 70 or 80. On the back of those kinds of moves, 5, 10% move isn't that much, but it's still notable. It's a marked change of tone. So if you're trying to think of what's happening going forward, the fact that these like market leaders are rallying on the back of bad news, that's traditionally a sign of a bull market, and certainly a turning point. So that's something we're watching quite closely.
So two things. So one is the perfect storm, just going back to your point around NVIDIA, there's been basically this massive oversupply of chips. And so now there's basically a glut in the market. And so they're basically expecting lower forward sales for some period of time. Did I understand that correctly?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's already happening. They're down, the graphics chips are down 28% year on year. But it's just starting in the sense that all those, for example, all the chips that are used for all the graphics components that are used for cryptocurrency mining will soon hit eBay. And you can track the demand for these things by secondhand sales. Like, is there a premium, which is rare, but across the board in many different categories over the last kind of year, you're seeing premiums for secondhand products because you just can't get your hands on the first ones. And then you can also track discounts, you can track the amount of stock. And all of a sudden you're going from like an immense tightness to immense glut. It actually feeds through into inflation because you're seeing that in other parts as well, where it's almost happened in the last, it feels like the last few weeks, but really it's kind of been happening over the last probably couple of months where one by one, these like supply constrained components are going from massive tightness and undersupply into a massive oversupply. And obviously the stock sold off 6 months before. So the market was ahead of it on the way down when Nvidia was still posting amazing results. And it looks like there may be a chance that they're ahead of it on the way up as well.
It's funny that it kind of follows these the classic commodity cycle, where it's kind of tightness followed by glut, and everyone kind of overinvests, and then everyone finds themselves underinvested, and kind of the classic capital cycle. And so now, so I guess that 4% rally, what does that kind of tell us? Does that tell us that the market's been, you know, duly kind of pessimistic to this point and kind of anticipating this result? And so now, you know, it's kind of all this news is kind of flushed out, and we can kind of expect a kind of normalization and like, what does that mean? Is that just bull market? How do you think about that?
Well, it gives you the best possible insight into positioning and how people are positioned. So people are clearly very underweight this. People probably sold the stock in anticipation of a weak result. The results come out, and I guess there's more buyers than sellers. But I'm not saying like rush in and buy Nvidia now. Like, this could be, you never really know how long these cycles go. Obviously, parts of their business are still booming, like data centers. But there will no doubt be a glut. But you've seen other companies, so the leaders. I'd say like the true leaders are things like Snowflake, Bill.com, CrowdStrike is reporting next week. Amongst the growth space, these are considered like the highest quality, the most visibility into future revenue growth. And they've consistently grown exceptionally fast throughout this period. And, you know, Snowflake and Bill ripped 20% on their results, and now well off their lows, you know, like 50, 60, 70% or even doubling off their lows. Almost doubling off their lows now. So you are seeing that, and that it kind of happened at the beginning of this reporting season when companies like Shopify came out with the treasures results and rallied. You know, those companies have kind of like floated back down. There was no kind of reason other than positioning to kind of buy those stocks back. But the companies are actually delivering like really strong results that are down 75%. You know, that's going to change. I think it's an interesting one. The other interesting chip component maker is Taiwan Semiconductor, and actually Intel and AMD. Just seeing how that the interplay of that. We own a little bit of AMD, but have largely stayed away from Taiwan Semiconductor. I feel like the last thing we need is another kind of Chinese flare up issue. But you know, Taiwan Semiconductor made the decision many years ago that they would just manufacture chips and be the best at like fabrication, and that has paid off in spades. So Nvidia, AMD, these companies like design them, and then they're made almost entirely by Taiwan Semiconductor. Apple's new M1 chip, you know, they used to use Intel. Now more and more of their products are using their own chips that they design themselves, but Taiwan Semiconductor makes. And you see, Intel has actually been caught in a really tight spot where it obviously used to be number one, but now it's kind of not the best manufacturer and doesn't have the best designs now. So it's the worst of both worlds. Whereas AMD used to be kind of, they compete with Nvidia and GPUs and Intel with CPUs. They're like that supplier that everybody kept because you wanted some competition. Like, it was a mediocre business. If the market crashed, you know, Intel would lower prices, and the excess capacity, the excess supply would kind of like land on AMD. You know, they would be the ones that kind of took the real hit. And they kind of do okay in the good times. Now that's all reversed. Now it seems like Intel is in that period. And there's clearly a big slowdown in PCs, sale of PCs. So it's been a really interesting industry to watch. I'm unsure if there's an incredible opportunity. Obviously, it's kind of fascinating industry because each of the companies, they're really high-tech businesses. There's a lot of very specialized equipment manufacturers at all the different parts. And often there'll be like one clear market leader that everybody uses, generally make money throughout the cycle. But there are these like cyclical upswings and downswings. So they're extremely high quality businesses with an element of cyclicality. It's very hard to pass through and see what the opportunity is. But I thought it was very notable that it rallied on the back of such an awful result. I think it's a real sign.
Why? What's, I mean, that feels like a really precarious position. What's stopping, you know, Intel or someone else building, you know, onshoring, you know, high chip manufacturing capability to the US? It feels like it being in Taiwan, and then, you know, that, you know, or the industry being highly concentrated there doesn't feel sustainable. I'm sure, you know, maybe we should have like a chip expert on here or something, or Oddlots have probably already covered this, but like, why can't the US kind of just invest massively into chip manufacturing? Or are they doing that?
I think that's the plan. And then Taiwan Semiconductor is moving is going to try and open up plants in the US. But I think the issue is, I think it's kind of like how everyone tries to set up Silicon Valley. Like it's decades of universities, top talent goes into these companies. I don't think it's an easy thing to do. I think it's like a highly technical kind of craft, and it's not like you can just set it up. You know, it's years and years and years of expertise and talent density that makes Taiwan so good at it. I mean, everybody wants to manufacture their own chips, right? Everybody wants a Silicon Valley, but it's very hard to create these things from scratch. I've no doubt that the US will get there. Obviously, there was a CHIPS Act, which they just passed. And everybody's now extremely aware of how relevant these are for defense. So every major country is going to look at what they can do to kind of have their own supply. It's one of the things that's really hurt Russia, it seems. Again, it's from the press, so it's hard to know. Everybody loves a story about Russia going through trouble at the moment, but apparently they can't find enough chips for their high-end components. So I'm sure they'll be thinking very hard about how they can set up their industry as well.
I remember listening to stories around China poaching all these top, the top tier Taiwanese talent, and basically just, setting up all these amazing apartments and giving them a gazillion dollars and basically free rein to do whatever they want, just to try and kickstart some of that capability in Chinese centers. So I'm sure everyone's very, very focused on this. So what else you've been following? What else is on your mind?
Well, just on that, actually, if there is a conflict in Taiwan and China, one of the early stages will probably be a blockade. If they want to make a big move without actually, invading or doing a direct military strike, just blockading Taiwan would really cause havoc for everybody, just because they won't be able to get chips out. In terms of what else, so Farfetch, that's one of the ones that I'm putting the list of things that we shouldn't have done, which was buy this earlier in the year. We wrote it from $16 up. It went all the way to 70. We sold out along the way. And then it crashed from 70 to 16. It's like, okay, here we go again. And then it just halved in 3 months. But they just reported, and before they made an announcement a couple of days before the report, basically they're partnering with Net-a-Porter and Yuke's with like the option to buy the both of those companies. And also partnering with Richemont. I hope I'm saying that right. So again, you've got a company that's gone from like $72, somewhere around there, all the way down to $8, or even lower at the lows. And at the same time, they also just reported top line of 20% growth. So this is a luxury online fashion brand in perhaps the worst consumer environment in over a decade, and the worst e-commerce environment probably since e-commerce was a thing. It's like the slowest growth these companies have ever had, the worst and declining in many, many parts. And they're putting through 20% revenue increases, partnering with their major competitors and bringing Richemont on platform. So huge wins. There's like three huge wins there at once.
What are they trading at?
I think the last I saw was about $10, and it's traded up about 10% in the pre-market. It was literally just a few hours ago that they reported.
Do you think about it in valuation terms? Like I can see now, I can see
Well, this is
here
going
the
to come
trend.
back. This is going to come back to our conversation last week. So they're losing money, but investing and growing. So they reckon they can get to 30% operating margins and 25 to 30% sustained growth over 5 years. I'd say that that's actually pretty likely. They've maintained higher than that in a really weak environment. They've done 20% on the top of very tough comps. So if all of a sudden 30% of the next few years is not unreasonable at all, especially when you consider we are in somewhat inflationary environment or in a very inflationary environment, so prices will be rising. It was at the lows, it was never quite one time sales, 1.1, 1.2, 1.3 times sales. And so you have to kind of look through that, say, look, if they can do a 30% margin, this is trading on, say, 3 times operating profit, probably with adjustments. Obviously there's many people who would say it's not making money, it's not worth anything. I think that's as silly as saying it's worth 10 times sales, which is probably what it's trading at the top, maybe more actually. I'm gonna pull that
It
up.
is funny. I reckon this is going to be a recurring theme with us. Your first port of call is always kind of flows and price movements, just because, you know, that's the world you live in, and the world I live in is okay, well, what does it do, and you know, how should I think about, like, kind of fundamental value, and, you know, what should I believe in, and so, and then kind of, you know, share, you know, price movement and the like. It's always kind of secondary. I reckon that's going to be recurring between us.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the same thing when it comes to business analysis. Like, this is like market leader online fashion. Even with this new GMV coming on platform, there's still 3% of the market. It's one of the most underpenetrated e-commerce sectors, certainly when it comes to fashion, that luxury high end. So there's really good fundamental backstory to it. But of course, any of these growth companies, you're not going to be able to value them in the same way. You know what I found though? I think there's a lot of small cap kind of growth, but profitable kind of GARPy, if you know what GARP means, growth at reasonable price stocks that fell as much as growth stocks. Like Crocs is one example. You know, it went from like dropped 65% plus, like two thirds were cut off its value. These are growing companies, often with 20, 30% top line, like 4 to 6 times after tax income, like genuine after tax income that you can see on the cash flow statement and using that money to buy back shares. So there's a lot of, we've, I think something like 40% of our portfolio now is buying back shares. So I think when we come out of this, as we come out of this, the companies, it's clear there's two companies that are performing and bounced really hard. The first are the ones that there's kind of GARPy plays that got really, really cheap on an after-tax basis, are still growing and are buying back shares. That buying back shares, like you can put the ones that are buying back shares and the ones that are diluting into oblivion into like two buckets of the growth. And then the ones that are at break even are kind of in the middle. And there's like a straight line between how well they've performed. The other ones that have performed really well are the ones that have actually maintained growth. So companies like Shockwave, companies like Bill, companies like Snow that are still growing at 75% plus, in some cases 100% plus in this environment. Now that all those things have moved in the last 2 months. So if anything, it's kind of like, kind of validated the ones that actually grow have like performed extremely well, or not well from the top, but certainly well from the bottom. But then there's a whole category of fallen leaders of
Yeah.
what's a
Well,
Shopify, your Twilio.
speaking of buybacks, two buybacks caught my eye this week, kind of moving back to Australian markets. One, Whitehaven Coal. So that's one of my personal investments. I've kind of been bullish coal ever since the Russia thing happened. And structurally, I think, you know, things that are on the nose ESG wise are just structurally undervalued, and I think you know, a lot of folks are kind of thinking about Australian coal in that way, and so just on the valuation basis, really attractive. And they announced a buyback yesterday. The second one is Qantas. Now, I definitely do not own Qantas, but I did know, I think yesterday they announced a $400 million share buyback. And the reason that's interesting is because they were the recipient of, you know, billions of dollars of government support through COVID. And so if you kind of think about it, and like there's not much thinking needed to be done here, but they effectively were bailed out by government and given billions of dollars. And now, you know, a meaningful chunk of that has gone straight to, you know, lion shareholder pockets. And it's a dynamic that you kind of see, you know, consistently with airlines, you know, both here and in the US. And it's one I've never understood. You know, you can kind of retain the corporate structure and employees and you know, the physical, you know, the capital stock of airlines and the like, all kind of intact without enriching shareholders from time to time. I don't know why shareholders require some kind of, you know, special preferred, you know, government supported return here. It's kind of like, and then the second thing, I don't really understand why it hasn't caused more political furor. I would have thought, even just from a kind of populist perspective, surely it suits someone, one of the major parties or someone else, to just go out and absolutely torch Qantas over siphoning public funds to its private shareholders. So I've just been very confused about that whole situation. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that.
Yeah, like I think like Qantas has some weird place in Australian hearts. You know, it's just I didn't think it would be a great political move for someone to go and attack Qantas, the spirit of Australia. I think it'd be worse if they kind of let it go under. But you're right. I mean, shareholder subsidies probably have no real place.
Yeah,
Actually, no.
the message,
It's
you know,
tough.
can be very pro Qantas, pro national carrier, Spirit of Australia, and songs and whatever, what else do they do? Pro employees, pro unions, even. Just why, just go absolute hell for leather for like enriching shareholders and management. I don't know why, there seems to be, like some angle across the political spectrum. I don't know if it's like a buddy buddy thing and everyone's kind of in cahoots here, but it just seems like an absolute rot. And I feel like I'm taking crazy pills. Why aren't people, going out for a lynching? So
I
anyway.
guess at that time, everybody, or not everybody, but a huge number of people were benefited from government support. It's very hard to second guess those decisions at the time. And also, I think there's an example of like Ford and GM when there was kind of a bailout of sorts in the US. Like, it wasn't great for super great for shareholders, in the sense that a lot of there was huge dilution anyway. But I think you could have at that time, I think it was Obama, it would have been Obama, to either let those companies go bust and kind of lose all that like corporate. Everything that like a corporation consists of, like all the know-how, all the kind of like links, all that ability to just design and build a car, just kind of like vanishes, and everybody just goes from being extremely effective altogether to just being like disparate. Or you kind of keep the thing going, which invariably involves keeping management incentivized, potentially some level of shareholder, not necessarily shareholders actually. You could always wipe out shareholders and recapitalize, or effectively
Yeah,
wipe out shareholders
isn't
and
that the thing?
wealth.
Like, I totally agree. I'm not against government supporting in kind of, in situations where it's called for, and maybe the auto industry is a good example in the US or whatever. I'm not against even supporting, an airline through a pandemic or something. That kind of makes sense. But there are
Especially
different
when the government shut
structures.
it down, right? So I feel like
Yeah,
the government
so
did have
that's
an
fine.
obligation to support everybody because they forced everybody. They stopped people from
But
flying,
so
they
take an
forced everybody in
equity
their
stake.
homes.
Take an equity stake, do like what Buffett did
Yeah.
into Goldman Sachs, benefit from the upswing rather than just pummel taxpayer money to go to Qantas shareholders. Why are Qantas shareholders benefiting at the expense of taxpayers?
What was
Should
the
shouldn't.
mechanism? What was the mechanism by which cash was?
Here is cash. Here's a bag of cash,
Just
and
like through
we'll.
JobKeeper or some special travel component of
Yeah,
it.
I'm not sure what the exact mechanism is, but it just seems like the peak of hubris to then, you've kind of cut costs to the bone. Everyone's complaining about service and quality of the underlying product, and then you've received all this money, and then just like a $400 million buyback and basically a dividend out to shareholders. It just seems odd. But anyway, I was having a bit of a whinge about that. Then the other thing, not buyback related, but coal related, I noticed, this is probably well out of your universe, to be honest, well out of my day, just kind of read this in the paper. Nathan Tinkler's back in the paper trying to buy some coal mine in New South Wales. The reason this is interesting to me, and just for your listeners who might not remember Nathan Tinkler, is a bit of a character in the Australian corporate scene for a few reasons. A, he's a big boy, like Clive Palmer, and he's a bit of a character. Loves his race hounds and thoroughbreds. But the reason he's got a special place in my heart is he was my first deal when I started my finance career. I started in investment banking, and the first deal I worked on was the IPO of Aston Coal. And Aston Coal was a mine he owned. He bought it for something like 300, I'm gonna get this kind of loosely, for like 300 mil off Rio. This must have been like 15 or 20 years ago now. And then, a few years later, flipped it for over $1 billion. I think it was 1.2 billion, and he had debt funded a lot of it. And so, not only was that an unbelievable deal for him, obviously, and kind of, maybe made Rio look a little silly, but I've just been fascinated by these characters that are kind of double or nothing. He basically just went all in on funding this, and it kind of worked out well. And then he took those proceeds and went all in on the next coal mine, and he kind of kept doing that a few times. And he's just kind of come out of a 4-year ban by ASIC for insolvent trading. So then it all kind of blew up eventually. And I think it's just super interesting, both in corporate land, in political land, all these incredible careers. Some of them are not built by, you probably have two models. You have one model of success is kind of incrementally being, 55% right for for long enough, you know, for decades, and outperforming the market over decades, and kind of being a wise, careful, hedged soul over time. And the other method is just going all in on black and kind of winning enough times, and someone comes out on top until you kind of blow up. And there are a range of kind of political examples of that, but I just find his story, you know, super interesting. He's an interesting character, and it looks like he's going for it again. I think it's awesome.
So you double or nothing on his play. I think I know the answer.
You know, I'd be totally in. Like, honestly, like, I don't know. I have no view. I don't really know what he's up to. But I think the two things I like about it: one is that Coles on the nose, and no one kind of has the balls to kind of go out and buy coal stuff these days. So if you are buying coal stuff, then those cash flows are likely to be undervalued. And then second, you know, he's done it before and he's kind of won. So, you know, I don't know if you'd want to partner with him, but
Probably
all in,
not
I think.
lend. You probably wouldn't lend. You might
Well, I reckon lending
might be
would be better
happy.
than equity. I see
Oh,
equity, you have to
interesting.
be a partner with him. Lend, you can take him to the cleaners if something goes wrong. So I'd rather lend to him than kind of sit next to him in equity.
Yeah, I guess it's like our Andrew Forrest, who's debt funded his mines, both the first
Yeah.
one, Anaconda Nickel, and then Fortescue. At least the equity to gold has lost out the first time, did exceptionally well the second time. Just shows it's worth backing these people. Like sometimes after the failures, they do their best. Do you know what I did see was interesting this week was so Texas basically set out the governor said they're gonna divest every asset holding they have in BlackRock, because they're hostile towards fossil fuels. I thought that was interesting because
That's
obviously
super interesting.
all the big asset managers that manage what hundreds of billions or trillions of dollars, they're all like, we're ESG, we're divesting our coal. It's created huge opportunities for a handful of people who are like, there's an Australian fund. I was speaking to somebody who worked here saying they were like the number one institutional buyer of coal stocks globally, you know, over the last year. And obviously, it's done exceptionally well out of it. But, you know, everybody, it was like proper herd behavior, everybody just divesting these assets all at once. And then, yeah, I mean, like Texas is an oil and gas state. That's where people work. It's very
It,
important to
it
them.
it's an absolute no-brainer. I was at a talk of you know, the senior private equity guy about I don't know, about a couple of years ago now, and he had just changed. He left a big global in Australia to start his own thing, and he was telling a room full of professionals. He was like, "Look, if I could, I'd raise the funds to go up and buy all these coal mines, because you know it's an absolute no-brainer." And so it's interesting. It's almost plays that that was kind of obvious at the time, and has remained obvious. But most institutions are just constrained from participating. I think it's a super interesting trend where you've kind of got these $20 bills on the sidewalk for anyone who kind of cares to pick them up. I think it's interesting you mentioned Andrew Forrest from FMG. I've spoken to a few drillers out west, because we used to be involved in a drilling business, and you know, back they tell stories about back in the day sharing a campfire with Andrew Forrest, and him telling them, you know, we're going to be the third force in iron ore. And they thought, yeah, you know, you're dreaming, you know, after BHP and Rio, this bloke kind of sitting at the fire. And he did it, you know, and he bought these kind of second tier assets, and they obviously worked out extremely well, and he became the third force. And I think those kinds of stories, you know, are absolutely inspiring and unbelievable. It's funny, when you go to WA, their entire psyche and you know, way of doing business and thinking about opportunities is so different to the East Coast, you know, to the finance set. Everyone there loves to have a punt, and everyone there dreams of being the Andrew Forrest. And so you've got these, you know, it's a cultural thing. Obviously, they're very mining linked. And I imagine you might be similar if you go to Texas or you know, Chile or elsewhere. You know, the culture there, the business culture, really follows a kind of mining mindset. And it's super interesting to see up close, and it's just a different way of doing things.
Yeah, I mean, one thing I found interesting about Fortescue was really the story of how, you know, dreaming big can like really save you. So I remember I was investing in like some small iron ore companies many, many years ago, then there was a crash, and basically all the minnows went under. It's like Atlas Iron, Mount Gibson. The price collapsed along with a bunch of other commodities. But Fortescue had this lever in the sense they had enormous mines. So they were able to lift production and drop their costs because they were so big, they had that lever. Whereas the smaller mines that were marginal just didn't have enough. They weren't able to ramp up capacity. And I remember at the time, all these bear cases, oh, look, Fortescue, they're just mining the easiest bit to mine. You know, they're drilling whatever it was, shallower or deeper or whatever it is that, you know, you can kind of get cheaper ore today, but you're going to get more expensive ore later. But at least Fortescue had that lever, you know, at least they could do that. And then supply wrapped up, costs came down, and they survived, and then obviously boomed afterwards. But if that was Andrew Forrest, not only made more money than all the other entrepreneurs who set up smaller mines, but he also succeeded where they failed. You know, they didn't have the size, they didn't have the scale that when the industry really turned, they didn't have the capacity to turn on, increase volumes, and get those costs down. I thought that was a really interesting part of the story as well.
Oh, and that's not to be understated. You know, they really struggled. You know, there was a period where they were, you know, significantly overlevered. Not just them, you know, the whole industry was significantly overlevered. You know, cash flow was massively down, and they kind of scraped through. They cut the cost of their production aggressively. I don't remember exactly where they started, but I call it like $50 a ton down to, you know, $15 a ton for you know, for their main mines. And so you're absolutely right. They kind of worked through on the other side. They had a way lower cost to produce, and when the price for iron ore kind of zoomed up, suddenly they're just printing cash hand over fist. And that opportunity, it's incredible.
Longevity, yeah, in a few years, like, it's amazing how long, like, 3 or 4 years is, and B, how short it is, and how much a difference it can be, like, boom to bust, scrape through, do you make it, do you not make it, and then if you make it through, wow, the years after that can just be phenomenal.
I think about that all the time. You know, someone said, you know, the decades are short and the days are long. You know, even in contracting businesses, you know, I was talking with a founder of a $20 million revenue business, and he was embarking on this new strategy of kind of, you know, it was a new market, basically, offshore market, where, you know, he's got a sales team and he needs to win work, and the sales cycle, you know, as intended, and he understands this, is, call it, you know, 9 to 12 months. And so he's like 8 months in, okay, and he hasn't got a meaningful sale. And at that point, success and failure look identical. And he doesn't know if he's winning or losing yet. He could be dusting a whole bunch of money and he could have egg on his face, or
that's,
he could be on
that
track.
Idea, if you don't know if you're winning or losing,
you don't know, because our psychology, our reporting cadence, if he's reporting to the board every month or every quarter or whatever, you know, like, what are you reporting? Your sales cycle is 9 to 12 months. Like, you'll only know after like 2 years or whatever it is. And so, and even if you know that, you know, intellectually, emotionally, you've still got your heart in your throat, you know, every time you're doing that. And I see that, you know, happen all the time. You know, like, in, you have to really think about what is the cadence of, you know, within the business, whether it's sales cadence or whatever you're measuring versus reporting and thinking about it. And, you know, month to month, there just may not be nothing to kind of meaningfully discuss from that perspective.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, obviously, I'm like in a hypercyclical business where you go through these cycles, it seems like almost every year at the moment. but, you know, it's like going back to those companies like Farfetch, like, is it winning or losing this year? You know, they just made huge progress. They've gone from being, they just partnered up with their biggest competitors and grew 20% on a blowout year. But they've probably had the worst or huge contraction in value and market cap, the biggest in their history by a very long way. So by one scorecard, it's their worst year ever. By another, they've just taken a huge step forward just over the last 6 months. There's quite a few companies in that bucket, actually.
So what's their play? Like, are they consolidating to, you know, effectively combine and cut a ton of costs, or are they kind of creating this portfolio of similar brands or luxury brands like an LVMH in the space? Or
LVMH,
before
they're
before
doing
answer that.
Yeah, go.
I was going to say, on the cadence point, another really nice example is what Bezos says around, everything you're seeing being reported about Amazon today, was kind of locked in 3 years ago. And so you kind of got to think in like 3 year cadences effectively. Anyway, that was just another data point. Now I'll, go ahead.
Well, I think in for these companies, particularly in e-commerce, there'll be like that COVID period, there'll be this period, and then there'll be what they do to react to it, and how they perform coming out. So Farfetch, the thesis around Farfetch is it's a really thematic one. And it's apparently why they set the business up. So luxury fashion was extremely resistant to online sales. They didn't want to put their stuff up on websites. They didn't want to be discounted. They didn't want to be easy for anybody to just buy it. They want that sense of exclusivity. Maybe there's a handbag that sells out. It's all about that sense of exclusivity, that sense of luxury, that feel that you get when you buy a product. They're really resistant to online, and certainly very resistant to going on a platform. To the extent they want to go online, they'd want to do it themselves. And even now, the top brands are very resistant to it, like Prada, for example. Farfetch's idea is, well, we'll create a platform for luxury brands that is different. So, kind of like in some ways, a little bit like a Shopify, only designed entirely for luxury brands. So the whole feel of it, I say Shopify, it's actually quite different because Shopify doesn't have a storefront, whereas Farfetch, you go to their website and you can see everything, and boutiques can put their shops online as
It's like
well.
an outlet. Is that the right way to think about it? It's like
Yeah,
a
it's kind of like an
premium
online
outlet.
outlet. And the idea is that if they think they penetration now is about 3% online of their market share, sorry. And the vast bulk of luxury is not done online. Like it's laggard, it's a laggard
So
relative
they
to
reckon
luxury.
luxury penetration is 3% online.
So that's Farfetch's total GMV, including the recent deals.
Okay, so that's their
So yeah,
market share rather.
it's closer to market share. But again, luxury is hard because obviously if you buy a t-shirt, you could argue that's fashion. But there's obviously a huge difference between a $1,000 t-shirt and a $20
And my
t-shirt.
$5 Kmart t-shirts.
Uniqlo, very into Uniqlo at
I hear that a lot. I'm just so down with my $5 Kmart t-shirts.
Well, it does the job, it fits well. So that's kind of what Farfetch has been investing for and going for. They had a few hiccups. They made a decision to like take on a lot of stock, then they kind of reversed that. Now they've kind of got their platform solutions where brands can just kind of use them as their back end, which is kind of the idea here. They're going to integrate across these other websites, do the back end for Richemont. But really, the benefit obviously here is that they're just no longer competing. So on price, on things like that. It also fits luxury. Like really, a luxury brand doesn't want to go to like put their stuff on three different sites who'll then discount. You want
They
kind of
want
one relationship.
exclusivity and they want,
Exclusivity and control
curation.
over price and control over stock and discounting and things like that. Obviously, there's a company in Australia called Cettire, which is extremely controversial in the investing community because it listed, went up a lot, then went down a lot.
How do you spell it?
Cettire.
I
That's a
never heard of
completely
it.
different business. Yeah, it's more of a, I'd describe it. We're not shareholders, but we did own it in the past. It was pretty good to us actually at the time. But really it's basically it's the CEO, as far as I can tell, was quite entrepreneurial. So he went to kind of Italy and got all the warehouses to agree to allow him to put their stuff on his site, where people can then buy it. But all the shipping, the delivery, the returns, all that's done by these various suppliers he's got. Now with luxury fashion, often there's like restrictions over what you can sell where. The company won't tell you anything, by the way. So this is all reading between the lines. You can't sell this part of the season in this part of the world at this time. But the stuff that doesn't sell, well, why wouldn't you sell that in Australia if people want to buy your excess stock that you couldn't sell? It's that kind of thing. It's really complicated. Inventory management, very careful to like follow the seasons. But what it means is there's lots of warehouses that end up with different stock that they can sell in some parts at some prices, but not in others. And that's what Cettire puts on their platform, as well as more broadly. Some brands are just happy to have another retail outlet. If it gets you some sales, it gets you some sales. Now the problem is that Setai doesn't actually do any of that. I think when we spoke to them, there was like 27 employees running some pretty serious GMV numbers, reported GMV numbers. But if something goes wrong, it's a pain in the neck. Like, I'm sure you've dealt with, where you feel like you're dealing with somebody and then you realize actually they're just a front for somebody else.
Yeah.
So yes, you can try and like get your returns from Setai and they'll process it, but really that has to go to some random place in Italy probably.
Oh yeah.
You have to send it back to them and they're managing that. It's going to be an atrocious experience. So you just have to kind of, if you use the site, you just have to accept that you're getting this stock. And there's a good chance it's a stock that was left over from the last season, but whatever, the price is right. You like it, take it. It's not going to be some smooth, seamless Amazon type return experience. You know, it's going to be tough. But the other issue is, ultimately, I wouldn't say if it was double or nothing there, I'd be a nothing. It really just feels to me like more of a drop shipper.
Yeah.
And I think if you're going to go in a business, like that's a relatively low quality business.
It's like Wish for fashion.
Something like that. Yeah. It's a platform. Like they don't have the stock. They don't have the brands. They don't sell. They don't do anything. They don't have inventory. They're really just like you click the button and the sale goes to somebody else. And then that person sells it to you and they kind of handle the front end. But if you have a business that's low quality, that's when you don't want to be valuing them on an EV sales basis. Let's put it that way.
Sure.
You know, you want them to be making money, to be buying back shares, to be distributing dividends. If you're in a low quality business, like you just have to, they have to be making money and you can't pay up for years in advance. Certainly if the profits aren't there at all.
You don't want to be using EV sales as a valuation matrix for anything. Like the only reason we use it is like sometimes you need to. Because companies losing money and you're looking through to a future cash flow or EBITDA. Yeah,
you have to do it, but I talk about it because it's easy. You can talk about something that's consistent for that company, particularly in its historical trading period. You know, for that company, if the company's roughly the same, you can put some element on it. It's to me, I talk about EV sales the way most people talk about stock price. Like to me, stock price is irrelevant, but a multiple, at least it kind of normalizes for the change in the company. So you can talk about, okay, this stock is up three times, or what's the company done? If the company's up three times, it might still be roughly similar on a value perspective. So that's, I use it the way other people use stock prices. But I will say that you can use it, you can expand it. So there's a company, Marley Spoon in Australia, and it's doing hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars of revenue, losing a little bit of money, but trade, I think at the lower traded for like 50 million. And the reason you can use EV sales, not necessarily in this case, but let's say in a private equity case, if you actually have control over a business, it's like, and that company is growing. You get control of the business. You raise prices by 5%. If it's one-time sales, or in this case, much lower than that, like 1/10th time sales, you know, if you can get a 10% margin, you're getting operating earnings. And often businesses have that lever, right? They can just switch off growth. They can switch from growing to harvesting. You can just raise prices to the point that you're profitable and just see where your revenue lands. At least you know it's going to be profitable revenue. And if you're trading at 0.1 times sales, you've got a ton of margin then. It's probably quite possible to get, you know, to take a business. I'm not necessarily that one. I don't know enough about it. It's not something we do. But take a business trading at like 1/10 of its revenue, make a few improvements, jack up prices, increase margins, stop investing for growth, and all of a sudden make your money back on an annual basis. Like every year.
So Marley Spoon's a funny one. I remember just as COVID hit, that was one of the eye-popping share price return ones. I'm just looking at share price now. So on the 6th of March 2020, just you know, it was 25 trading at 25 cents. It popped to $3.55. So like, you know, what's that, 150 times or whatever it is. And now it's back to 24 cents.
10 times, yeah.
So,
but you know, what's its, obviously this is going to run into revenue questions, but let's check in with like what their revenue's done over the period. I bet you it's
grown massively. Hey? Yeah. So obviously, you know, online grocery delivery would have grown a lot, you would have thought, through COVID. So let's have a gander. Yeah.
Look, I think the hope is, I think the bull side would also be like some HelloFresh is a giant and could buy Marley Spoon for their entire growth capex.
So its revenue through to December 21, apparently in euros, I'm just looking at a CapIQ, was 322 mil. and it's trading at a 70 mil market cap. So
Is it
something's
the same
fundamentally
currency?
broken in this business. It looks like it's probably because it's operating incomes, like, so its EBITDA looks just headline, like, it's losing 45 million bucks. So it looks like its unit economics are broken, is what it looks like to me.
Yeah. But I think the play was, I was speaking to an analyst, and again, this is what I haven't looked in this deeply in the last kind of year or so, but it was kind of like the within 2 to 3 years, they could get to 1 billion Aussie of revenue. Global contribution 27%. Yes, they're losing 5 million euros a quarter. So say 20 million euros. Maybe next time we'll check in and run those numbers and see what it would look like if you could actually
Yeah,
do it.
let's see. We're kind of doing this live, but I guess, like, I hear you. Like, I mean, I think kind of, the idea is always to kind of grow to a big revenue and then kind of pull back on costs, and you've got kind of spitting out cash. The challenge here is that the fear here is that you're selling, a dollar for 90 cents, and that, really,
Yeah.
every dollar that goes out the door, they're just going to lose money on, and there is no magical cash flow at the end of the rainbow. That's the
What
challenge.
I'm saying is, as far as I'm aware, not their strategy either. So they're going to keep growing at 20, 30%, likely keep losing money, and likely need to go back to the market.
Yeah.
So what I'm saying isn't even the strategy. That's something. I think it was
Yeah.
Murdoch or Pack. I remember he was buying up newspapers at like ridiculously low EVs, like unprofitable businesses. So the owners were like, this isn't making any money. I'm happy to sell for a really low price, but huge revenues, and then
But
get in there, crack
newspapers
the
are
whip.
really different. Like, so newspapers, you can just rip out all the costs. You can just rip out all the printing costs, all the
True.
distribution costs. You can consolidate it, and so
You can do content. You can use content from
you can
different
use
websites and different
content, and that's why they're
pages.
kind of crappy. But there's actually, they used to be absolute money spitting machines with, like, EBITDA margins of like 50%. They used to be local monopolies effectively. Then came the internet, and obviously, I think Buffett had a similar play in the US where he bought up a bunch of newspapers. And the truth is, you just rip out all the back end, and they can start making money again. It's really a really lovely yield play. I think, high, delivery, high capex kind of businesses, like, selling at like negative contribution margin or low contribution margin, that's like way
Yeah.
scarier.
I think they need to raise prices until the point they're profitable. It's the only way, I think.
But
Yeah, I think
then,
the.
the reason they haven't is because they've got no price power, because they're competing against Woolworths and Coles and whatever here. So that's
Also
the,
possible. Also possible.
yeah.
And it might just be the fact that people are really attuned. It's like, if you're spending, you've got some idea if you're overpaying for your dinner or not, probably.
Yeah.
So maybe that extra 25% that they need to
People
raise
complain
prices.
about 10 cents on a bottle of milk or a carton of milk or whatever. So, yeah,
We
so I
actually,
think.
back in my private equity days, we invested in a company that was actually doing local newspapers, believe it or not. And that
Did
play
it work
was,
out?
I think they made five times or something. Exceptionally
Nice.
profitable investment. Basically, the play was you had all these disparate newspapers, but each of them has a really good local advertising market. So this is I don't know, the Nottingham Express or something. Like everyone in Nottingham wants to know like what's happening in the space. So you actually got a really active, like lots of plumbers will advertise, but there's no point in a plumber advertising on a national paper. It's worth them, potentially worth them advertising on a very local basis. And so they're really good businesses locally. And I think what they did is they actually stripped out all the content, sadly, all the editorial, all that stuff. That stuff got done in London. And you might be reading, the Manchester, What Herald or whatever it is. I'm just making up these names. But the stories will all be written, they're all the same all around the country. You'll have like a very small group of reporters who like do all the content, and then centralize all the advertising, but then keep the advertising local. And obviously they bought this for next to nothing, cut every single cost for all, think of all those little offices. Probably not great news for journalists, but it was good for the business.
Well, that's a
Not
global trend. That's
lying.
what's happened in Australia as well, and that's why you've got, a ton of regional papers that aren't worth very much. They're getting the same content out of kind of city centres, and they're losing their relevance. But they're kind of yielding the ad value, and I don't know. It feels like a nice kind of interim money spinner for owners, but it's probably not the long term solution for local news and content. And who knows what happens to that? Should we? I think that's an awesome place to leave it, I think, unless anything else you want to add. I thought, one thing I think we should, I'd love listeners to give feedback on, is who should we have on as a potential guest and spitball with us. But before we wrap up, anything else you want to chat about?
I think that's a good place to leave it.
Yeah, that was really
Let's see you next
fun. That
week.
went all sorts of directions. I'm enjoying this.
It was. Thanks, Misha. We'll speak soon.
Awesome. Cheers.